Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. This is the Entree Architect Podcast, episode 84. Welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, whether you're in the process of launching a startup, or you might be an experienced small firm architect just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. Many of us have this dream of starting our own architecture firm. And others, like me, we've already taken that plunge and we've launched our firms. But the first question that we all have after we make that decision is, how do we find work? How do we get noticed by the clients that we want to work with? Well, this week's guest on the Entree Architect Podcast has some answers for us. He's a residential architect based on the eastern coast of the United States, way up north in Maine, on an island called Mount Desert. And he has developed and tested some very interesting ways to get noticed and to fill his board with high-end projects that he wants to design. This week on the Entree Architect Podcast, we are speaking with architect Eric Reinholdt of 30 by 40 Design Workshop, and the author of the new book, Architect and Entrepreneur, A Field Guide to Building, Branding, and Marketing Your Startup Design Business. This is the first episode in our new Field Guide series, where Eric and I will dive deep and share routines, rituals, tips, and tricks for hacking your design practice and becoming a successful entrepreneur architect. This episode of the Entree Architect Podcast is sponsored by the Entree Architect Report. That's my free weekly newsletter. Subscribe at entrearchitect.com/newsletter. Eric Reinholdt, welcome to the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
Yeah, I know this is going to be a good one. You and I have talked in the past. We talked a little bit before we started our recording here, and we are both two passionate guys about making the world a better place through architecture. So I think this is going to be a knock it out of the park episode here. So let me introduce you a little bit first to the people who don't know who you are. You're you're an architect. You're the founder of 30 by 40 Design Workshop. That's located up in Maine at Mount Desert. And you are the author of two books. One is called The Unofficial Guide to House.com, which is an excellent book. It's basically all you need to know about House.com and how to get noticed on that platform. And your new book, Architect, is it Architect and Entrepreneur or That's correct?
Yes. Yeah, that's
so
correct.
It's architect and entrepreneur. It's a field guide for building, branding, and marketing your startup design business. And links to both of those books are on your website. And your website is a beautiful site. It's 30by40.com, spelled out, 30by40.com. This site itself is a great model for any small firm to look at what you're doing. That alone is worth this episode. If you go to 30by40.com and see what Eric is doing there, he has a great portfolio of beautiful architecture. He has a great blog that's very video focused. He has videos that he's developed, beautifully produced videos about architecture and the specifics about design and architecture. And the blog is sort of focused on that. And he even has a lead capture tool on the site that while you're looking at it and seeing it, and he has a checklist that you can download. And so he's getting people who come to his site who are interested in what he's doing. He's getting their information and giving them some valuable information in the process, which allows him to sort of talk to those people later on and continue the relationship. So a great model, Eric. You've done at the website is really great. And you know, through our conversations over the past year or so, maybe even more than that now, I think you're an all around great guy trying to make a difference in the world through architecture and by sharing the knowledge, you know, that you've gathered through what you do and sharing it with other architects, which is very near and dear to my heart. So I thank you for doing that.
Oh yeah, you're quite welcome. Thanks for that. Thank you for saying that. And that certainly is the goal.
Good. And I think this podcast episode will add to that, because I think that we're gonna drop some bombs here. In a good way. So before we do that, let's do what I do every time. Let's start with your origin story. Let's talk a little bit about you before we get into the nitty gritty here. Talk about when you discovered architecture and sort of talk about what inspired you to become an architect and your journey to where you are today.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think my relationship with architecture maybe is somewhat atypical. You know, as a child, I was always enamored with model building and scale drawings. And so, you know, in grade school, I would go to the local bookstore and I would buy these sort of floor plan books. And this was the 70s, so it was all these sort of solar homes and pretty gnarly floor plans. I would just take them and redesign them. And so I was really in love with technical drawing, model making, and architecture seemed like a natural fit. But honestly, as a 17-year-old, you know, I think I was pretty unprepared to make any kind of career decision. So being an architect was a romanticized interest of mine when I applied to schools. But it really wasn't until I got into the coursework in architecture school that I really realized just how much depth there was to the field, the sort of theory and history and, you know, design concepts. I mean, it was a new world. And thankfully, I mean, it was something that I sort of fell in love with. And so, you know, I went to Roger Williams University, also your alma mater. And
Roger Williams.
I graduated in 96. And as an intern, I began working on some really large scale commercial, institutional, and educational projects sort of throughout the Northeast. And it was great practical experience, but honestly, it was very removed from the sort of, you know, house plans, the drawing that I sort of fell in love with as a child. And so it's sort of, you know, when I finished up my internship and sat for my licensing exams, I became a licensed architect sort of at the same time my wife had received her PhD, and she was looking around for a job, and she ended up finding a job here. There's a world-renowned genetics institute on Mount Desert Island, and she got a job there. And what was great about that for me was the island was sort of developed and settled by the Rockefellers. They actually ended up donating a lot of the land for Acadia National Park, and it became the perfect opportunity for me to practice kind of high-end residential work. So there's a big summer community here, and you know there's an influx of people buying second and third homes. And so I sort of partnered up with a local design-focused firm, and I worked for them for about 12 years. And sort of as the recession took hold in 2008, 2009, we had a slow couple of years, and we finally got to this point where Rather than thin the ranks, the partners sort of asked everyone to take a 20% pay cut. And so that pay cut, we were given the option to continue working a full 5 days, a full week. We just wouldn't be paid for the fifth day, or we could seek other work on the fifth day. And for me, that was Fridays. And so I sort of took that as an opportunity to start laying the foundations for 30 by 40, you know, which is my, my business today. And so on my daily commute, you know, I would listen to podcasts. Of course, I would listen to, you know, the Entree Architect podcast, Pat Flynn's Smart Passive Income. I'd listen to Tropical MBA, This Week in Startups, Internet Business Mastery, all these things. And I, at that time, I read The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss, which totally changed my life. It really gave me a new perspective. And I started building this just love for business. And you and I share that together. And I was kind of surprised. I mean, none of this was in my design schooling. Like, business was just totally missing. And so it was, you know, architects like to learn. And so I loved just the depth of learning that was, you know, there. And so, you know, I started thinking a little bit differently about how I could build a design practice in today's economy, and, you know, eventually transitioned to, you know, fully operating 30 by 40 on my own in June of 2013. So I'm just past the 2-year mark. And I think it, you know, kind of brings up this idea that, you know, working, you know, we buy into this myth that working for somebody else really offers job security. And that's what I thought for a long time, you know, being an employee. I get a paycheck every 2 weeks, but really, you know, the change in my personal work situation really just highlighted the fact that really, if I wanted job security, I had to create it for myself. And honestly, I'm still kind of figuring out what that looks like. And it's a little bit different each day, but I'm, you know, I'm trying lots of different things.
Yeah, that's a great story. The, and Mount Desert Island Desert, I mixed those up, but it's Mount Desert.
Desert.
And so it's an island, and it's pretty remote. I mean, it is a relatively high end community, but it's, you know, it's a limited market for what you do. Mm-hmm. A question that I very often hear from the Entree Architect community is they're in remote locations and they're trying to start a business, and they're struggling to do that. They're struggling to find that first client, or even once they're established a little bit and they do have a couple of clients, how do they find the work that they really want to do? Because maybe there's work, but it's not really the work that they want to do. Right. You've built a pretty successful firm on Mount Desert Island. And so how did you do that? How did you go from zero to where you are now in 2 years?
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of hard-won lessons, honestly. It's a great question. I think, you know, number one, I worked for a firm who did work that was closely aligned with the kind of work that I wanted to do. So when I first moved here, you know, there was lots of options. There's lots of residential architects around here. And I looked around and I found the one that was doing really good work, like award-winning work. And so I was able to, over the 12 years that I worked there, I was able to work on really great projects. And excuse me. So I built up a portfolio of work. So that's number one. If you don't have any experience coming out into a remote location and asking people to hire you, they're going to really question what your abilities are, you know, what kind of work can you do? And that will sort of set the tone for your business, what you'll be able to sort of come up with, and the kind of work that you do. And so that was sort of step one. The second thing that I'll say is my current practice right now, I have a few projects locally, but actually a lot of my work is sort of remote. So I practice all around the country, doing work in South Carolina, in North Carolina, in Seattle, looking at something in Park City, something in Austin. So the internet has sort of democratized the practice of architecture in a way that, you know, when I first started practicing in 1996, that there was no way, this wasn't even an option. And the way I did that, and the way I get these sort of projects more remotely, is I really focused on building a brand that looked like the work that I wanted to do. And so that started with the foundational, you know, building projects with this other firm, getting, you know, my name out there that way. So I have this portfolio that I can rely on. And then I start promoting that. It really, I'm able to craft this sort of brand message. It's a singular brand message. Like, this is the kind of work that I do. It looks, it has a certain look to it. And I really built my brand around that. And then I'm able to take it to a place like House, which is a giant source of traffic, especially for architects, interior designers. There's lots of eyeballs on House, and you know, people are ready to hire architects there. So I'm able to take my brand on House, and people are willing to, you know, hire me based on the reviews that I have on my House profile, based on the portfolio of work that's there, and you know, the way I've built up my sort of presence, my brand presence on House. It's no different. You know, I'm experimenting with things on Amazon and other sort of traffic channels. You know, if you find a place where, you know, there's lots of traffic, there's lots of clients waiting, and you put a singular brand message out there, you'll find out pretty quickly who's willing to buy and what they're willing to pay for that. And that's kind of how I've built that. You know, even locally, it's hard when you're working with $1 million plus budgets. You know, people don't want to take, a lot of times don't want to take a risk on a new practitioner. And so I found that to be at times a stumbling block. And so being able to spread my business presence across the sort of world globally has just given me that many more options. And then once you start getting these projects, it kind of builds on itself.
It snowballs. Yeah. That's really important. I want to make sure that the people who are listening here heard what you said. The first step you did was to align yourself with another firm and get a job with a firm that's doing the type of work that you want to build your brand around. So you're working within that environment, working with that type of client, designing those type of projects, building a portfolio that then you can potentially leverage as you move on, acknowledging that work is work done in a separate firm, but it was designed by you. Mm-hmm. And so that was the first step. So if you started in a giant engineering firm and then wanted to do high-end residential, that's going to be a hard transition to sell to somebody without having that experience. Then the second thing you did was to build a brand, which is very mm-hmm. important. And then you leveraged that brand on places where there was traffic.
That's correct.
So when you're out in the middle of nowhere, you need to find a firm that you're working that is aligned with what you want to do. Then build a brand that represents what you want to do. And we'll talk about that mm-hmm. in a few minutes of how to do that. And then put that brand out there. Find places where there is traffic, where there are people who are looking to spend money on architects or architectural services or architectural products, and get your name out there through those rivers of information that are already out there, that traffic that's already out there looking for what you're trying to sell. And that's how Eric has gotten to where he is in 2 years.
That's right. And there are little seeds that you plant all along the way. I mean, none of these sort of sprout up overnight. It all happens as this process of taking sort of concentrated, you know, focused action over time. So if you consistently work at it, those things sort of bear fruit.
So how did you build the brand? First of all, where did the name, what was the name inspired by? And then talk about how you, and what's the difference between giving a firm a name and putting up a logo and building a brand?
Sure. Yeah. I think, you know, very often the first place people start when they're sort of envisioning, you know, starting a business is with the logo and what it looks like. And I think that's great. It's an important exercise, but really I started with a step back from that, which was coming up with a foundational concept, much like you would a design concept. And so my idea was to try and infuse the name of my company with a sort of narrative story. So the work that I do is sort of narrative driven. It has an architectural concept behind it. There's a story behind the buildings that I do. And a lot of my work is inspired by agrarian, you know, agricultural structures, really simple, humble structures, basic materials. And so I wanted to draw that sort of inspiration into the name of the firm. And so 30 by 40 is the proportions of a New England sort of threshing barn, an old English barn. And, you know, that idea that I would call it 30 by 40 sort of inspires someone questioning it. You know, so someone comes to meet me, and it's usually the first thing people will ask. And so there's a story behind that, and I get to talk about, you know, why the dimensions are, you know, were what they were. And so there's this architectural history to it. And then, you know, I also wanted it to be representative of the process that I use. And so design workshop was really this idea that a workshop is the place where you go and tinker with things and create things that are, you know, you kind of hack things together. You see what works, you see what looks good. And so those two things, you know, married to come up with a really long name. And I talk about this in the book a little bit and some of my misgivings with 30 by 40 because, you know, there are some problems when you're naming things. You need to be thinking smartly about how it works online, what your domain looks like, what kind of search traffic you're going to be capturing. So I get a lot of search traffic for 30 by 40 workshops, which isn't a lot of what I do, but you get the idea. I think there's a story behind this brand name, and then the logo. Honestly, it's sort of the last thing. If you look at my logo, there's nothing. Yeah, it's a text logo.
It's very simple. Yeah,
it's simple. But it's also the last thing that I've worked on. It wasn't the first thing that I worked on, because getting the logo up and getting someone to design that, you know, that can happen at any point. Getting the story behind it and starting to build the brand, that's the important. That's where the hard work is. And so I think people start with the logo because sometimes that feels like the easiest thing to do. We're designers; we can solve those problems really easily.
Right. And I think that's the fun stuff, you know. By focusing on the fun stuff, you kind of avoid the hard work. And really, you need to do the hard work first, and then you can fill in the fun stuff later.
And the brand can pivot over time. I mean, that was a story, and I've had different tags. You know, I tell people to kind of, in the book, to sort of brainstorm taglines, you know, and, you know, I had one simple modern home design, and then I changed it to something else. And I think that's where I'm back to now on my webpage.
Yeah, it says simple modern residential architecture.
Okay, so yeah, I'm just trying to capture some SEO traffic with some of that. But
I think that really does tell the story about what you do. It's very clear. And I think that also represents, you know, the logo. You say the logo is very simple and not very developed, but it actually is very representative of what you do. It is simple and beautiful. It's, you know, the proportions are very well done. The color choices in the neutrals of black and gray, I think, are pretty modern and you know, representative of the type of work you do. I think it's a good logo for what you do.
Oh, thanks. I guess I lucked out.
I think it's interesting though that you brought up the negatives of the name. The you know, for lack of a better word, the failure of the name. Because sure. I think that there's a tremendous benefit to the name. But talk about a little bit about how you did struggle with that and what others should be thinking about when they're naming their firm.
You know, in terms of how I struggled with it, I've learned to sort of take these things and learn from them. But I'm not, certainly at this point, I'm not ready to change the name of the business. There may come a point where I'm ready to do that. But you know, my approach is to sort of take that lesson and use it and apply it to the other aspects of my business. So like, you know, now I know a lot more about SEO and, you know, search engine optimization, how traffic, you know, finds my website. So having been through that process, and looked at the analytics, you know, on the back end of my website, I understand where things, you know, where things sort of went off the rails with the name. And so I'm able to take that and pivot it, you know, into how I create videos, how I tag videos, how I write blog posts, the content on my homepage. So all of those things, everything with my business is kind of an experiment. And then, you know, I learn from it, and then I pivot and I try it again. You know, I see how that experiment works. And so, you know, I guess I don't have a good answer for how
I think that was a very good answer. I mean, because the fact that, because I have the same problem with Fivecat. Mm-hmm. Fivecat has nothing to do with architecture, but it has a lot to do with our story and who we are and where we've come from. And it provokes that conversation that said, why did you name it that? And then here's why. And so I think there's a benefit to having a name that has a story behind it, but I think that it's just something to think about, that when you are building a brand that is going to be very web focused in order to build that. If you're out in remote areas, or even if you're not in remote areas, the first thing people do, even if you're in the heart of New York City, the first thing they do is they search Google for architects. Right. And you need to be there. You need to be in that traffic. You need to be on Google when they're searching for the architects in your area. You need to be on that first page. And so whatever you need to do, and we are, even with the name Fivecat, we're in the top two for Westchester County architects. For the past decade, we've been there. Wow. And we've overcome the fact that the name is Fivecat. And
that's
so,
right.
So it's just, I don't want to spend too much time on that, but I mm-hmm. just wanted to point that out. So I want to get a little bit more back into the book, because I think the book is great. It's sort of a technical handbook and sort of a narrative, a story that you're telling about how you did what you did. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about of how you built the business and how you make it successful today. We've talked about it a little bit with the routines and the things that you do. So let's share a little bit about that.
Okay. I think there's kind of the reason why I wrote the book was because, I felt like the resources, at the time that I was building this business were kind of lacking. I really, felt like there was nothing contemporary. There was nobody sitting down and looking at this objectively, like what the internet meant to people practicing architecture. And especially as we talked, I'm a remote firm, and so it's harder to find clients, and I need to rely on the internet. And so, writing the book, it kind of arose out of this standard methodology that I've adopted since opening my business, where I try to sort of wring out value of everything that I create. So when I research something, whether it's business or software training or design or a client problem, I take all that research and I kind of repackage it, and I use it to kind of cross promote my business through all these different platforms. And so when I was just getting started building my business, I sort of bought into this just-in-time learning concept where, like, I needed to know something about how to structure my business. I was going to go and research it. I was going to research it at that moment. And then I basically sort of wrote it down. And so the content for the book kind of naturally evolved and coalesced as I was building my business. So I had a question. My early questions building a business were all sort of mindset focused. Like, is this the right thing to do? Like, am I crazy for wanting to do this? And like, what kind of questions do I need to ask? Like, how much money do I need to save? Do I need to even save any money? And so the chapters of the book kind of sort of grew with my business. They answered the questions that I had at the time. And, I started writing each one along the way. And, part of the process of writing the book also helped me to evaluate things in my business that needed improving, like my business model, how I was structuring my business, my SOPs, my contract. It kind of gave me a framework for doing all that research and making those changes. And I thought sharing it in book form would help others sort of, answer, facing similar questions to help answer those questions. And along the way, the writing became, a habit, which reinforced and created this sort of ethos of experimentation, which I've taken and applied to all the different aspects of my business. Does that answer your question?
It does. The it's literally a field guide. It was literally your field notes as you were developing your business, rather than developing an architecture project. You were developing and figuring out how this business was going to be built and structured. And along the way, you were taking notes in order to learn what you needed to learn. And those notes then evolved into an outline. And from an outline, it became a book. And so let's go back we developed the brand. Then we're finding these sources of traffic. Right.
Yep.
And so, mm-hmm. and so that was really the magic, right? I mean, to go beyond Desert Island to the world, you needed to develop this brand and get into these flows of traffic. So,
yep.
And the book was one source of doing that. What were some of the other things you did to get noticed beyond the island?
It's so my the house book that you mentioned in the opening was really, that was probably one of the primary vehicles that I used house pretty extensively. And it was that's another example of me sort of experimenting with this sort of stream of traffic and figuring out what worked for me. And along the way, I just kept a bunch of notes. And so then the book evolved and I wanted to share it with others and say, like, this is how I made it work. And so Howe's contacted me because I was blogging. You know, like, I was trying all these different things. I really fell in love with building my website and sort of internet marketing, all these ideas swirling around, like how you market a business to globally. And so I was trying all these different things. I was trying blogging. I was trying making videos. And so through my writing, an editor at Howe's contacted me and said, oh, you want to try and write for us? And I said, sure. Yeah, why not? So I wrote a few articles, and I realized pretty quickly that the exposure that those articles had was just massive. A typical article that's featured on their homepage gets between 70 and 100,000 views very quickly, and it sits there for, you know, in perpetuity. It's published in German, it's published in Japanese, it's published in Australia, it's all over the world, wherever Howe's expands to. And so it's again this idea about seeds. So I started planting these seeds and I ended up writing for them as a contributor, which is still something that I do regularly. So once a week I'd come up with a piece on architecture, and I really used that to highlight the kind of work that I wanted to do. And so I was finding initially I was publishing these stories and people were like, well, why don't you publish the same story but do it with a traditional focus? And, you know, that just told me that I was doing the right thing, because I realized, like, okay, this is pointed at a very specific group of people. And what started happening was people would start getting in touch with me. I would publish an article and I'd get a few phone calls and people say, oh, I read your article. I'm really interested in the work that you're doing. Because all of the images that I used in the article were correlated with the kind of work that I do. And so I used Howe's pretty effectively, and it continues to really pay off for me very, very handily to market my firm. And those, you know, that gave me the sort of elbow room to be selective about clients that I choose to work with. I mean, I can, you know, accept projects locally that maybe aren't a perfect fit, but if I'm able to spread this sort of brand message out sort of, you know, to the far reaches of the US and the world, and have someone resonate with that and do the work that I'm interested in doing and they're willing to pay my rates, then, like, that seems like a really, really perfect model.
Yeah. When you started on Howe's, when you started writing on Howe's, did you first develop your profile and then start pitching to Howe's, or did you realize Howe's was a great source of traffic and generation back to your website, and so you offered to write there?
Yeah, I wish I could say I knew more about it, but at the time, like I said, I was kind of trying everything. The blogging on your own website, and I mean, you know this from having built your own audience, it takes a while. It's a grind. It takes a while for anyone to notice anything that you're doing. So, you know, my thinking was, well, I know there's a lot of people on Howe's. I didn't actually know how many people were there, but I might as well go there. You know, that's a captive audience. They're going to edit my pieces. They're going to promote my pieces. They send it to their email list, which I don't know is in how many millions now. There's something like 16 million monthly unique visitors to their website. I mean, that's just huge. And so to get in front of those people seemed like a no-brainer. I had a pretty basic profile built. I had a few reviews. And as I started to build up, you know, as I started to spend more time there, I realized, oh, okay, this is how I rank on Howe's. You know, there's all these factors for ranking, and my writing and people adding, you know, my photos to their idea books, because that was a sort of another hack. I would write these idea books, but I would also include images of my own work in there. So I would correlate my images with other work that I liked and, you know, thought was appropriate. Of course, nothing local, but people far away. And so I started to realize, okay, this is how Howe's works. And having figured that ecosystem out and being able to rank there, then started sending more traffic to me. And again, it's kind of this flywheel that builds up. You build all this momentum. I've put a lot of sort of labor into writing for them and crafting good, what I think is good, appropriate brand focused content. And it's really paying back because people are just there all the time. And a similar thing with YouTube. The reason I don't write blog posts on my own website anymore is I sort of take the content that I work on for House and repurpose it into YouTube videos. So I record these videos, and YouTube is, you know, the second largest search engine. So it's another giant stream of traffic. And so that sends people to where I, you know, I have this, I think I have maybe 800 subscribers. It's not a huge amount, but what it allows me to do is test all these things. So I can run tests on YouTube by uploading videos, products that I want to build, sort of, you know, I run experiments that way, and I can see who gets the most, you know, which video gets the most views. And so that helps me move my brand in different directions, or makes, it helps me to make more choices. So the more traffic you have, you expose yourself to, the, you know, the better your sort of testing model and pivoting model becomes.
It's interesting that you have this broad network that you have. You've built the brand on your website, which is the first step. You really need to have the website ready, because everything's going to lead back to your website. And right. the website needs to be very specific to your brand and who you're representing, or who you're trying to appeal to. Then you have all of these sort of these arms out. You have House, and you have YouTube, and you're on Twitter and Facebook and all of these different places. And you can... The thing that was interesting is that, because I talked to a lot of architects about being in all those places, and they say, well, I don't have the time. But what you said is that you repurpose, that you develop this article for House, or you could even do it the other way, develop for your blog and then repurpose whatever you're doing on your blog to other places. But you specifically write for House, put your own photos in that article. Then that article links back to your House profile, which is very important. That also has to be developed and optimized to a specific way for that to be recognized, which you talk all about in that book, in the unofficial guide to house.com. So anybody mm-hmm. wants to know how to do that, you can get that book and figure that out. Eric also is available if you want to tweet him. I'm sure he's happy to to help you get there too. But you take all of the information that you've developed over this time for this one article for House, and then repurpose it on your blog as a video on your site, and then the video is sitting on YouTube, so it's also on YouTube, and I'm sure that you also put it on Facebook, and so it's all the same information. So you're not writing four or five different pieces of content; you're writing one piece of content, and then pulling it apart and repurposing it for all these different places. So you're taking maybe 10 hours worth of work and focusing it down to maybe 1 or 2 hours worth of work. Is that correct?
Right. That's correct. And you get to see pretty quickly which things, like on YouTube, obviously long videos don't work well. So if I've written a long piece, it doesn't get very many views. And so you start understanding each one of these channels is important. But thank you for sort of summarizing that idea of this sort of hub and spoke, right. You know, idea where at the center of this hub is your website. So everything that I create out in the world sort of refers back to that. And increasingly it's, you know, I'm taking that hub and saying, okay, well, maybe that hub is Amazon, or maybe that hub is somewhere else, and kind of running experiments with that. So, you know, people have a harder time. I think once you understand these channels, like something like Amazon, people have their credit cards stored with Amazon. So people are ready to buy on Amazon. People aren't ready to buy on my website. So if I want to sell something, you know, I have to have that sort of understanding. People are ready to hire architects on House. And so have your profile ready, have your portfolio looking good, have some reviews there. And people will call you directly from House. But you know, something like my website selling plan sets, it's been a harder thing to do, because, you know, oh, am I going to give this guy my credit card? What am I going to get? You know, whereas when it's on Amazon, it's totally legit. Everyone just implicitly trusts that this is a good thing. Plus they can see the reviews. And so I would say, yes, there's a repurposing of content, but there is also some sort of nuance to, you know, understanding the channel, that you're using. That's all.
Yeah. And so it's taking the books that you've written, and which is a strategy to get your name out there and your brand out there, mm-hmm. and putting them on Amazon. So you're out in that that traffic. So now you're using Amazon as a traffic generator back to your website.
Right.
How many architects are doing that? That is a great tip right there. Figure out some sort of tool. You can even put together a booklet. It doesn't have to be. You can do an ebook that's 50 pages long. You want to do something of quality because it's representing your brand. So remember that. You can't just put junk up there in order to get back to your. It has to be something that represents you and what you do. So it takes some work and some effort and some design. But then get that onto Amazon. And then now you're in that traffic flow that's yeah. generating things back. But even on top of that, not only is it a traffic generator back to your site and a referral service, essentially, it's also a passive income process that every time you sell a book, you're getting a check in the mail. You check your bank account or your PayPal account or however you're getting paid. And while you're working, you're getting, notices that somebody's paying you, which
that's
is,
right.
I experienced that as well. And that I can tell you, every architect on the planet should be coming up with some sort of passive income, product or service that you can, provide to your audience, and get paid. Once you put it out there, it's just literally a passive income.
That's a wonderful feeling, getting that email, yeah. like, or checking your stats, like how many downloads you had of your book today. And just to sort of expand on that a little yeah. bit, I think for the small firm architect that is sitting in a really remote location, passive income makes a huge difference. It's made a difference in my practice. So having, an extra couple of thousand dollars a month in passive income means that I can be more selective in the kinds of projects that I take on. It means, maybe I don't have to take that small renovation project that's not quite the right fit. I can wait a little bit longer. My runway is a little bit bigger. I can be a little more selective. I can say no more than I say yes, which I think is a hard thing to kind of get used to as a small firm architect. But that really, this again, feeds back into brand building. I want to accept projects that look like the kind of, project that I want to work on, the kinds of clients I want to work with. And they don't, living in a remote location, they don't come along every day. And so you have to have some sort of padding in there to make it, to sort of smooth out the bumps. And passive income is a great way to do that. It's not easy to get the flywheel going, but once you do, publishing a book on Amazon, it's so dead simple. I think, the barrier to entry is so low. And, I would even skip calling it an ebook. I think there's some sort of, there's some sort of negative connotation to that. Amazon owns CreateSpace, which, prints all of my books on demand. So I'm not holding on to a locker full of 1,000 books. Whenever someone orders it, they print it and send it, Amazon Prime. They'll print it overnight and send it overnight. So it's a really wonderful service that you can leverage like today if you wanted to.
Yeah. When you said a couple thousand dollars a month, I heard everybody's ears went perk up. because that's significant money. That's not, it's not 50 bucks. That's a significant revenue coming in passively. That once it's out there and once it's developed, and it's a lot of work, I can tell you, it's a lot of work and a lot of time to develop the products that are out there. But once they're out there, they generate income forever and continuously. So could you just, I think that's a subject all in itself. So if you're interested, I'd love to have you come back and talk specifically about passive income for architects, because I think that is a subject that everybody wants to hear. And I think it's a bigger subject than we have time for now.
But yeah, absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing now to generate that kind of money?
Well, I sell plan sets on my site. And again, that's an thing that I'm always experimenting with. Is the price point $2,500 for a plan set? Is it $250? And so I'm running experiments there. I'm price pulsing those things. So I sell more at the lower price point. I have to sell more at the lower price point to recoup the same amount of money that I would selling them at a higher price point. But the higher price point means a lot more handholding. So, I'm sort of playing with that. Obviously, my income from Amazon and, publishing things that way is a good part of the passive income component. And it's one of those things that I've realized, you know, there's a huge buying public out there. And so that's been a good lesson in experimentation for me. And then I make it through affiliate commissions, that products that I represent or promote through my own social media channels, through the book, through my website, and advertising. So advertising on YouTube is becoming a good source of income for me too. So it's kind of this, like everything else, I've cast all these seeds out and I'm watching to see which ones are growing, and I'm ready to put more sort of office resources into the ones that are. And, you know, personally, writing for me has been really rewarding, and I see a lot of opportunity for that in the marketplace. I think there's a lot of stuff that's missing. So I think, you know, I would encourage people to poke around and look at what they do, you know, as, from a business standpoint, and see where their skills, where there are holes in the marketplace, and see how their skills set might sort of align with those gaps, and start making things. I mean, that's, you have to make things and test them out.
Yeah. And they have to, be of quality, and it is a lot of work.
True.
But the rewards are beautiful. And, you know, that, the feeling you get when you create something and you put it out there, and people start buying it, there's an acknowledgement that you've done something of value every time somebody purchases something like that.
So important.
It is a great feeling, and it is adding value to this, to our society, and it's putting our value as architects out into the world as well. Another way of getting our value communicated to society. One thing I wanted to mention is that our friends over at ArchiSpeak this week, also just their current podcast, episode 66, is they have the Greg Lavadera of Lamy Design, who is also a house plan designer and an architect near Philadelphia. They have a great conversation on the current episode called House Plans, on episode 66 at the ArchiSpeak podcast. I just wanted to mention that.
It's a good one.
It was a really good one. And they talk about passive income through house plans. And so we'll definitely have a second episode here with you, Eric, to talk specifically about passive income for architects. And I think that'll be a great subject. Do you want to share some of the tools that you use before we wrap things up to sort of do what you do?
Sure. Yeah. I think there's, you know, there's obviously kind of two categories of tools that I think about when I think about you know, my own practice, and I have sort of a certain set of routines and rituals which I use, which I think have contributed a lot to my success. I don't know that we have time to go into that today, but I think the two categories
we can have a third episode, no right, problem. Yeah.
I'm happy to let anyone, you know, communicate with anyone who's interested in that. I actually have started writing a book on specific rituals too, so that's another sort of side project. But the two categories are really sort of mindset tools and sort of practical tools. And in the mindset toolbox, these are really important, actually, and they sound oftentimes kind of really kind of fluffy, I guess, but they're so important. And I think, you know, the mindset piece was perhaps the most difficult for me to get over in the beginning. You know, I always had this sort of fear of failure, and that's the thing that I talk about in the book, really having to overcome. When I started my business, I had this sort of idea of opening a business cooking in my head for a long, long time before I actually did anything about it. And you know, I think a lot of that was because of the fear of failure. And so I think it helps to imagine the sort of worst possible outcome as a way of sort of feeling the fear, but then controlling how you react to it. And, you know, the worst possible outcome, you know, of starting this business and getting rolling on this entrepreneurial journey, the one that I came to was, you know, that I would just have to get another job. So really the opportunity cost for not doing this was much, much higher. You know, I accepted that fear and I sort of moved forward. And so I think that fear of failure sort of makes itself known, all the time as a sole practitioner, and the voice of doubt sort
no
of
doubt.
Is,
It is a constant conversation I'm having in my head every day on everything I do.
But I think, you know, you really don't have to accept anyone else's definition of who you are or how you'll practice. And a lot of times those, you know, those fears of failure are you looking at it through someone else's lens and, you know, thinking that they'll think of you as a failure. How you support your family really is up to you. Yeah, and I think it all starts with this mindset idea, like defining what success means for you. And for me, it means sort of three things. It means the freedom to do what I want, that there's purpose, that there's something driving me every day. And the third thing is relationships, that I have friends to share my life with. And those things sort of go beyond business. And, you know, your business is a part of this. But if without those three things, no matter how financially successful my business is, I wouldn't consider myself a success. So I think, you know, those are a couple of sort of, you know, mindset tools that I am constantly reminding myself of. And I think if you put them at the top of your sort of to-do list for the week, you can really focus your efforts on the things that are important, the things that'll drive your business forward. You know, and I obviously have a lot more tools like that. Some of the practical tools, I think doing the math is really important, and I have to do the math all the time in my business, just like you do, Mark. But what I mean by that is, you know, figuring out what the target revenue is and really tracking that. And I like this kind of ramen profitable metaphor. You know, in college, you ate a lot of ramen, right? Yep. It was pretty awful stuff. But this isn't a sushi and sake diet that we're living on. This is, you know, how can you trim your monthly expenses down to a minimum that you need to live? That's the thing that sort of builds all this freedom for you to make choices about where your brand is headed, the kind of work you want to do. So go with a ramen profitable budget and you will find your way to success, I think, a lot faster. Obviously, there's developing SOPs, standard operating procedures, you know, how you communicate with people. All of these things feed into what your brand looks like to other people. There's building an email list. So there's a lot.
And I think this episode is a great introduction to Eric Reinholdt, because there's probably four or five additional subjects that we can, you know, have a conversation.
I agree.
on this podcast with. And so let's do that. Let's share some of that on future episodes. We'll definitely do that. You and I will discuss which one's next, but I think we can do this as a series. I would love to do that.
That would be great.
And get deeper into some of this stuff, because 45 minutes to talk about all of these things is not enough time. And I would love to use this sort of as an introduction to who you are and to what we can do, and maybe make this a podcast series and get deeper into some of these subjects that we talked about today.
Sure.
If you're interested in doing that.
I definitely am. And I think we both share that the idea that, you know, this isn't a zero sum game. There aren't winners and losers. Like, I'm here to help people, and it's why I wrote the book. It's why I'm here talking with you. And so I love business geekery. So happy to share what I know with you and your audience.
Yeah, and I know my audience is interested in what we're talking about, because that's why they're here. So we'll definitely have you back. Your world on the internet is 30by40.com, spelled out, 30by40.com. You are Eric Reinholdt at Twitter. So it's at Eric Reinholdt. It's Eric with a C, R-E-I-N-H-O-L-D-T. So it's Eric Reinholdt on Twitter. YouTube is YouTube/30by40. I'll have all these links on the show notes, so you can just go to episode 84. So entrearchitect.com/episode84, and we'll have all these links. But Facebook is facebook.com/30by40design workshop, and house is house.com/pro/Eric Reinholdt.
That's a
lot of stuff to remember. So just go to episode 84 and the links will be there. What's the best way if somebody wanted to reach out right now at the end of this episode and connect with you, ask you some questions about what you're doing? What's the best way somebody can get in touch with you?
They can send me an email, Eric at 30by40.com. That way I'm insured to get it and respond in a timely fashion. And I hope people consider picking up a copy of the book if you found anything here today that we talked about of interest.
There is a link on the show notes for both books. So if you want to go straight to Amazon, it's Architect, basically Architect Plus Entrepreneur, and you can search Eric Reinholdt, but there'll be a link to both books on the show notes at episode 84. Eric, I want to thank you, first of all, for your dedication to the profession and for sharing the knowledge that you have gathered over the years with anybody who will listen. And I thank you very much for coming on today and being so transparent with what you're doing and for sharing with my community here at Entree Architect.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Yeah, I'm glad to do it. Thanks, Mark.
And stay tuned. We'll have additional episodes coming forth. So thanks, Eric. Thanks for being here.
All right, thanks.
If you'd like to leave a review for this show on iTunes, just go to entrearchitect.com/iTunes. Or while you're in iTunes, just search for Entrepreneur Architect and you'll find us. But even more important to me is that you share this episode with a friend. We are growing here at Entree Architect. We're becoming an influential force in this profession, and that only happens with your help. So go to your email right now and send the link to everybody you know, entrearchitect.com/episode84. Send it to everybody you know. Share a tweet, post us on Facebook. Get it out there. I appreciate your support so much for what I'm doing, and I thank you for spreading the word. Complete show notes for this episode and a direct link to download this episode may be found at entrearchitect.com/episode84. And don't forget the Entree Architect Report. That's my free weekly newsletter. When you subscribe to that, I'll send you a short, easy-to-read email every Friday morning direct to your inbox with links to the weekly blog article and each of these weekly podcast episodes so you won't miss one thing. I'll also share a weekly resource in that newsletter where I help you build a better business, be more productive, or live a happier life. And I share my thoughts for the week at a much more personal level than the blog or here on the podcast. And I share some of the behind the scenes of my life as a small firm entrepreneur architect. So if you're not already a subscriber to the Entree Architect Report, you can sign up at entrearchitect.com/newsletter. And before we go, the quote of the week. This is a quote from our guest today, Eric Reinholdt, right from his book, Architect and Entrepreneur. And that can be found. You can buy that book right from his website at 30by40.com, or you can just search for it at Amazon. The quote of the week, even simple barriers can be cleverly disguised as an excuse, a red light for not progressing. Opening your design practice doesn't require all the lights to be green. It all starts with action. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect. I appreciate you. I thank you. Please spread the word about what we're doing here, and I'll see you next week.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns. What's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gary. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.